Welcome to You Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, on the Saturday before Christmas, I've rounded up a few of my favorite things, some of my favorite segments from 2015. We'll take a look at the restaurant documentary, For Grace, with Indie Film Fest Executive Director Craig Minns and local chef Neil Brown. We'll hear about the IMA's Avant Brunch with the museum's Scott Stulen and chefs Alan Sternberg and Andrew Whitmoyer. Then we'll head into the kitchen at Ivy Tech Community College with instructor Cindy Hawkins of Circle City Suites as she gives me a lesson on making souffles. And we'll talk tenderloins with local performer and tenderloin connoisseur Rick Garrett. But before we look back at earlier shows, we'll check in with Carmel native and Food Network personality Ted Allen, who will be in town January 16th and 17th for the Fantastic Food Fest at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. We got Ted on the phone the other day to talk holiday traditions. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Yes, it is almost Christmas, but I can't help looking ahead just a bit to January. Next month, January 16th and 17th, is the Fantastic Food Fest at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. And the Food Network's Ted Allen, also from Carmel, will be doing a demo there. Now, we'll have more with Ted in January when we get a little bit closer to the fest. But today we're talking holidays. So we got Ted on the phone to find out what he's up to for Christmas and New Year's. And we ask a few quick questions about holiday food and drink preferences as well. First of all, how do you celebrate Christmas and New Year's? Do you have parties or crowds or quiet or just family? You know, what's it like?
Well, we're having a Christmas party this year. We've done it once before. We hired a great piano player who's fantastic. And I just got back from my neighborhood cheese guy who's going to make a couple of cheese and charcuterie platters for us. And we've decorated the house with wreaths and garlands and that should be really fun.
Yeah.
That'll be our more active party. For the holiday itself, we'll do a very traditional dinner, usually. The turkey I mentioned with about salted about 4 days ahead of time, inside and out. New Year's, we used to go to a neighborhood party and then we're right next to Pratt Institute, which is an art school, really excellent art school, that every New Year's Eve there's a guy there that collects antique steam whistles and pulls them out into the middle of the quad and connects them to the steam generator at their power plant and makes an ungodly noise for hours. It's hilarious. the kind of steam whistles you'd see on an old ship or a locomotive.
Oh, my gosh.
People go over there with champagne and hang out and toast the new year. So we might do that. Usually for New Year's, we do something really quiet with friends and avoid what I think of as pretty much the biggest amateur hour of the year.
Exactly. Exactly. Are there some of your favorite foods for the holidays that you like to always have around Christmas or New Year's?
Very traditional. Honestly, there's a stuffing recipe that's on Epicurious that came from Gourmet magazine in 1975. And
I make
that every year. Classic sage and butter stuffing with some cornbread in it. It does use the liver from the turkey, but there's nothing. But that's just a really subtle. You don't even taste it. It's a back of it.
Just don't tell anybody.
No sausage, no oysters, nothing crazy.
I do.
I mix it up. I tend to tinker around with the cranberry sauce.
Okay.
Usually a little Grand Marnier or
orange
zest.
Right.
But nothing too weird. It's that time of year where creative cooks want to mix it up a little bit, but at the same time, it's so much about traditions that if you mix it up too much, people are going to rebel and be upset with you.
They will. You'll have a revolt around the table if that special thing isn't there.
Yeah. One of the things that you can also mix it up with, aside from side dishes, is try some different wines, maybe, or non-alcoholic cocktails, if you like. But I'm pretty consistent year to year.
Well, okay.
With big turkey.
So I've got some quick questions for you. Just this or that answers. All right. So, okay. So here we go. So, and maybe, and I think we've already kind of addressed this, but the holiday dinner, ham or turkey?
Well, actually, I really, really love ham. I love it. Especially those really nice honey glazed spiral hams. Mm-hmm. So I have no objection to having both.
okay.
And actually, ham, I think ham is way better than turkey for leftovers.
Okay.
In fact, I will, there's a company in Wisconsin that I'm not going to plug them because their delivery service is terrible, but they make a great ham. And you know, we're a family of two, and I'll still buy a 10-pound ham. And,
oh, I love it.
I love to cut it into like 1-pound chunks and then freeze those.
Nice.
And it's so handy to have around to dice up and throw into macaroni and cheese or use for sandwiches.
So here's some more then. Sweet potatoes, marshmallows or no marshmallows?
No marshmallows.
Okay.
They're sweet already. I don't approve.
Okay. Green bean casserole, never or always?
Why does it have to be never? Why can't it be sometimes? Sometimes.
Well, for the holidays. For the holidays, never. Right?
I don't make that. I like green beans with the way they are. I don't often cook veggies in cream. I kind of want the veggie to be green and vegetal and fresh, and there's so many other things that are heavy and butter, laden with butter, that I don't feel the need to do that.
Okay. Dessert, cake or pie?
Pie at the holidays, definitely.
Okay. And then what kind? Apple or pumpkin or pecan or what?
Well, all of the above are Canada. The one that we always make is pumpkin, but apple's a close second, and I love butter pecan pie.
All right. Fruitcake. Again, never or always?
Never.
Oh, never ever?
We used to have my uncle used to send us one every year. you know, I'm sure you can make a really good fruitcake.
Well, people say you can.
I'm sure you can. The one that we all joke about is the really dense one that's kind of like a doorstop. You could absolutely make a light, fluffy one.
Well, maybe with a lot of booze.
Yeah, that's not. There are a lot of things I'd rather have than that.
Okay. Wine, red or white, just in general?
In general or for the holidays?
Well, in general for the holidays.
I would say a light red, Pinot Noir.
Okay.
Or a Rhone, like a Grenache-based Rhone blend.
Okay.
Great with turkey. Both of those are great with turkey.
Good point, right, since you're making the turkey. Liquor, though, brown or white? Do you have a favorite?
Probably. I'm partial to a gin and tonic. Even most people think of that as a summer thing, but I like the crispness of that.
Well, I tend to too. So I agree with you. So with a martini, gin or vodka?
I don't believe in a non-gin martini. only gin.
Okay. If you were drinking
James Bond notwithstanding.
If you were drinking a brown liquor, a Manhattan or an old fashioned?
Manhattan.
Okay, and here's another one. Eggnog, never or always?
A small portion.
A little bit at the holidays, right?
Yeah, that's pretty heavy stuff.
We've been talking with Chopped host Ted Allen, who will be at January's Fantastic Food Fest here in Indianapolis. For more information on that, check fantasticfoodfest.com. So now we're going to look back a bit at some of my favorite Eat, Drink, Indiana radio segments of 2015, and we'll start with a piece from last July when I talked with Indy Film Fest Executive Director Craig Minz and local chef Neil Brown about the restaurant documentary, For Grace. We're typically more about restaurant reviews and movie reviews here at Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio. But the 2015 Indy Film Fest has started its 10-day run, and one film, one about a restaurant, of course, was a must-see for me, and I'm guessing for any restaurant fan.
An absolutely beautiful documentary titled For Grace, which is, if you're a foodie or a fan of restaurants or the biz, so to speak, it's an absolutely amazing film.
Craig Minz, executive director of the Indy Film Fest, which runs through July 25th with more than 100 films, tells us how For Grace became a part of the festival.
That was actually a film that was submitted fairly early on in the process and just got rave reviews from all of our screeners, and the points that were allotted for it were just stellar. So it was kind of an early shoe-in, so to speak, to make it into the festival. But yeah, it was. There hasn't been a person that watched that movie that hasn't been like, wow, you know, what a powerful film.
And it is. For Grace shows in stark detail the sacrifices Chef Curtis Duffy or any chef working at that level, at that 2 and 3 Michelin star level, often has to make. As the chef says, you sacrifice on every single level of your life. It's the lifestyle of a chef. The film also covers his difficult childhood and the tragedy of his parents' deaths, but it also shows how a devoted middle school home ec teacher became a key figure in his life. To create the documentary, Chicago Tribune reporter Kevin Pang followed Duffy for a year and a half through closing the restaurant where he was working, to the first visits at what would become his own restaurant, Grace, to opening night, and chronicles all the challenges along the way, including those in his personal life as a chef separates from his wife and deals with the sacrifices required of a chef at one of the country's best restaurants. I found the film to be moving and inspiring and fascinating, a real look behind the kitchen door and into the personal life of one of the country's top chefs. To find out, though, what a chef would think about the film, I watched For Grace with Indianapolis chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar. For Grace, you know, Curtis Duffy. So what was your reaction to the documentary itself?
Well, it's gorgeous. I mean, I think it really well captures sort of the emotional sort of side of opening a restaurant. I think they exhibited and captured very well sort of the, it's agonizing, right? Like to think about every single detail and then have to teach people every detail. Knowing that you're never going to be able to fully instill the passion that you have in these people, right? And that's pretty special. Like, I think that's what makes a great restaurant, is transferring that passion. So that was cool how they captured that.
Was it realistic? Because you've opened restaurants, you've closed restaurants. You know, is it real?
I think it was very realistic. You could tell that he was, when they closed, even though he, you know, in the beginning of that movie, when they were in Avenues, he said, I hate this kitchen. And am I unhappy here? Yes, I'm unhappy here. I think they, you know, they captured that. It's, you know, you're never satisfied, right? So he was trying to like convey that I just want something better. I want a place where I can showcase and do these things better. And so, yeah, that was, you know, that was a really poignant sort of, I think for him, that was probably the turning point to say, we just need better. If we're going to do better, we have to have a better space to do it in. So,
well, and he talked about not having enough coffee cups, not having enough, you know, silverware, you know,
and that's real. I mean, that's
real. Is that a real concern?
That's real. I mean, when I was seeing that, I was like, yeah, that's, you know, when the food and beverage director, the sommelier, has to be the expediter because you can't afford to bring on, a person specifically to make sure every plate is perfect. Yes. I mean, that is real. That is real life. I mean, that's how restaurants work. It's like, where do you make concessions and how many hats does each person have to wear?
What do you think about the story? You know, we've talked a little bit about his background because Curtis Duffy, you know, came from a very difficult, awful childhood background, you know,
yeah.
Murder, suicide, his father killed his mother and killed himself. So terrible background. Does that change, you know, how you look at him?
Drastically. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think if you don't know him, which most people don't, obviously, you think that this is a cook that, you know, came from Trotters, came from Alinea, and he did what all of us do. He just kind of worked his way up. But then when you hear really what drives that guy. And what drives that guy is not, what drives him is his own sort of, I think, I'm totally assuming here, but what drives him is his own sort of unacceptance of any kind of failure whatsoever, of being better than what he came from. And that is a theme that you will always find in restaurants.
Really?
I think so.
You think?
Well, I mean, restaurants are we all know this, and I think it's well documented that they're places where that accept just about anyone. It's like, you know, I think Bourdain sort of first sort of brought it to light that it's the land of misfit toys. And it's amazing when you think about a group of people who, Curtis Duffy did not grow up eating at a white tablecloth. You know, that guy probably never ate in a white tablecloth restaurant growing up. So how does he not only come from a place where he's never done that, but to get to a pinnacle, to get to the pinnacle of, like, this is what fine dining should be? I mean, that's nothing but his own mind saying everything has to be better.
Three Michelin stars, right? How do you get there from such a horrible, troubled life?
Right. How do you come from, you know, a small town in Illinois or a small town in Indiana and achieve three Michelin stars? And, you know, one of the things that I noticed in that movie was that they had, where a lot of places have at their expo table, they have blue tape. And this comes from, this is a tradition that was started at French Laundry. They have a message every day that they write. So the tablecloths are taped down at the expo station with blue tape. And at French Laundry, they write every day a new message on the blue tape. And it's usually something of like greatness or inspiration to remind people every day, you know, why you're here, why you're doing what you're doing. And I noticed in that movie that they had a strip of blue tape across one of the walls in there, and it said, "Are you going to be great today?" And each side had three Michelin stars, right? It had three stars on each side of that statement. So, you know, constant reminders of the gravity of what you're doing. We're not just here to cook. We're not here to have fun. We're here to achieve a goal. We're here to aspire to something far greater than what most people are able to achieve. And so constant reminders. And that's impressive.
Are those
how someone is able to motivate themselves to do that every day is fascinating.
How do you find the motivation to keep pushing forward? I mean, you're
fear of failure.
Fear of failure.
Well, it's fear of failure, and it's part fear of failure, and it's part, just your drive. I've always been driven by people telling me what I can't do, because that's what I'm driven by. That's what fuels me, is when people say, "You're out of your mind. This isn't smart." Well, I know better than you do. I'm confident that what I'm thinking is good and that we can make it great. He's taking that to an extreme level, just like Grant Achatz is, just like Wiley Dufresne did. And, you know, it's just, you just get it in your head that you can achieve greatness. And I think a lot of people do that, but executing is a whole different story.
So do you think the documentary is, think it's something that will appeal to the public, or is it too much inside baseball?
Oh, no. People love inside baseball. Are you kidding me? Yeah. No, I think it's realistic. Yeah, there's nothing fabricated. Agonizing. It's the guy got divorced during the opening of this thing. He literally sacrificed everything to make this restaurant great.
And that's realistic as well,
it's
right?
Very realistic, yeah. On just about every level.
That was Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar commenting on the restaurant documentary For Grace. Neil will be the chef for the Indianapolis Museum of Art's next Avant Brunch on January 16th. Now, Avant Brunch combines music with creative food served in an unusual museum setting. Another of my favorite segments from 2015 was a piece about Avant Brunch featuring the museum's Scott Stulen and chefs Alan Sternberg and Andrew Whitmoyer. Scott Stulen, curator of experience and performance at the museum, tells us how Avant Brunch came about.
The concept is to take this idea of really we don't sit down and listen to a record anymore, like all the way through. I mean, things are viewed as either background or you view just a song here and there, and it's just not consumed in that way. And I think in some ways, too, is that it's rare for people to sit down and really enjoy a meal and, like, taste it and take some time with it and kind of, it really is to slow things down. So it's to take those concepts but then put it into the idea within a museum setting or a different kind of unique environment. And then what happens if we make something that's very exclusive? So a record that hasn't been released yet is one part of the formula, a menu that doesn't exist at the restaurant, and then a space that normally you can't eat like this in it. So putting those three things together is kind of the components of Avant Brunch, and then we just mix it up and change it every time.
So what has been the response?
It's been overwhelming, actually. It's been really great. So the first one was kind of an experiment. I think it took a while for people to kind of understand the concept. So we're seeing, you know, some of our core members that you'd expect at the IMA to younger people coming in. And I think that's wonderful to see this kind of mix that are kind of, well, maybe want to have a unique experience.
So how do you decide on the food and the music and what people are going to be, how you're going to guide them through the experience?
So I've been working with Michael Kaufman on this, and Michael and I kind of go through some possibilities both in chefs and in potential record albums. So the one that kind of actually is the trickiest one is figuring out what music is like close to being released but not released yet, and then negotiating with the labels to get that. So it's kind of figuring out something, and that somewhat guides, use that to somewhat guide the chef that we asked to do it, and then so that the chef can have the record, both the art and the music, and like this time with Alan, to respond to. So really the idea is the response of the chef with the music. And so using the music is kind of the first kind of piece of that. And then we pick the space. And I would say really in all this, like how the cycle kind of goes, we kind of pick the space that's going to happen, match the music to it, and then have the chef respond.
And just how does a chef respond? Alan Sternberg, executive chef at Cerulean Restaurant in Indianapolis, created the menu along with Cerulean's pastry chef, Peter Schmutte, for the IMA's Avant Brunch back in January. I talked with Alan recently about how he came up with a menu inspired by music.
So for us, we listen to the music, and we both, you know, Pete and I both had this feeling of form. They kind of came about, and then we, you know, we wanted to be progressive because we felt the music was fairly progressive. We wanted to be kind of true to that spirit. So we went in a direction of we take a basic, simple kind of brunch or breakfast, or elements of that, and then we kind of made a dish around each one of them, and then we kind of figured out how we wanted to put it all together. So we went with a lot of organic shapes with some real geometric contrast to it, or vice versa.
That came from listening to the music, right? So you. Do you kind of describe the music as geometric?
Yeah. You know, my first thought was kind of, you know, shapes. And then, you know, there was this underlying organic sound to it all, whether it was, you know, wind or, you know, waves crashing against the beach or, you know, something along those lines, or, you know, a forest at night. But there were those elements there, so we... And then you have this real, you know, syncopated rhythm going throughout the whole thing, which kind of is what brought us to the whole geometric side of it, was this constant steady beat, or these very inorganic sounds, the electronica, that really kind of took me to that place of... almost like a screensaver, an old Windows screensaver where, you know, it'd be a kind of the ball thing that kind of shot out into different patterns or whatnot. So I think that really was kind of the first thought I had.
How do you make food represent that?
you want to embrace the spirit, I think. You know, so we took it, we didn't try to make food that tasted like the music. We tried to make food kind of look like what we thought the music looked like, you know.
Well, that's kind of, that's a cool concept. But again, how do you do that?
Luck, I guess. it was, we thought about it for a long time. And we mulled back and forth, and eventually we, you know, like I said, we just wrote a regular menu. Here's a brunch menu. Here's flavors we think will go well together. And then reverse engineered that back into the form. I think that was kind of the real focal point for us with writing the menu was, here's some outlying ideas of, you know, we want to do this. We want this form to be here. We want this form to be here. And then we kind of figured out after we wrote the menu what ingredients would work that way. Like, you know, the foie gras we served as little French fried size sticks that were broken apart. So they were super straight. And then you got this real jagged edge on it. That was kind of, we wanted to embrace and embody what the way we felt. Much like, you know, a painter does when they have a feeling and they put it on a canvas.
And that's part of the experience at Avon Brunch, or at least one of them, was that you listen to the music, you doodle with the pencils and paper that they have for you, and you're very quiet and you think about it and you're focused on listening and then looking at the food and tasting it. That's sort of an unusual concept. Was it interesting to be involved in that?
I strongly remember how terrible it felt when I walked out there every single time, because it is a very quiet event. So, like, you know, I never, ever, ever want to walk into my dining room and just hear pure silence like I kind of heard that day.
That wasn't your fault. I mean, they told participants to sit there very quietly. We weren't supposed to talk. And so we were sitting there doing what we were told, which was being very, very quiet. So it wasn't anything that had to do with whether we were enjoying it.
I know that now. But at the time, it was, oh my gosh, what are we doing here? But no, after talking to people afterwards, it was, the people that were there got it. You know, there was nobody there, I don't think, that wasn't there for that kind of experience. So, you know, there's lots of artsy people there, if you will, that really kind of dug on either the music. I saw some people walking out with albums they had bought, or, you know, the whole vibe of the event. They weren't your typical quote-unquote foodies, if you will. So I think for them it was kind of cool to see a different medium than maybe what they were used to.
Is it something that that you would recommend to people?
Yeah, because it builds culture. I mean, just because you don't particularly love something doesn't mean you shouldn't do it and be exposed to it. You know, there's a lot of great music out in the world, and a lot of it's not for me. But a lot of it can be, you know, wonderful in its own right. You know, whether it's Avant Brunch or any other cultural event, you know, I feel like people being out in the community, experiencing new things, only betters themselves and betters our community.
Now, Thunderbird Executive Chef Andrew Whitmoyer is creating the menu for the upcoming Avant Brunch, which is Saturday, June 13th at 10 a.m. So how did Andrew go about it?
It's something I love. I love being able to, I mean, when we do our dinner and a movie at Thunderbird, and it's like I have to pair a meal with a movie where, you know, it may be a movie where there's no food in it at all. So it's like, how do you do that? So I just take inspiration from that. And I've been, for this, for the Avant Brunch, I've been mostly where the music I would say is more like ambient and stuff. So I've been playing more on the title of the album, which is Bones, which I was like, well, that's perfect for me. And then, like, kind of the colors of the album cover and everything. There's lots of greens and pinks and some cool lines and stuff in it. So I've been kind of playing more on that side of things instead of the music, per se.
So what can they expect? Interesting things?
Yeah. I'm going to do a I'm going to have a drink when people come in, and then it'll be available throughout the brunch as well. That it's going to be, I mean, now strawberries are in season, so I'm going to do like a strawberry, mint, and basil fizz with like gin and champagne. And then I'll have like club soda there if somebody wants like a version of that. And then I'm going to have like an amuse and then four courses after that. So I'm going to do a bone marrow butter, kind of like a little crostini, some radish, and I'm like a little like tule cage on top, like a savory tule cage. One of the other courses is going to be a cold Asian noodle with a little chicken drumlet. I'm going to French on the end, so they get a nice little bone sticking out.
Then playing on the title, right?
Yep. I'm going to have a chicken, like a roasted chicken bone and roasted carrot dashi to kind of float the noodles in, so that'll be fun. I'm going to do a venison loin as well, coffee and spice crusted venison loin. I'll probably sous vide and then sear off and slice at service. I got a little for dessert. I'm going to do like a little bit of a strawberry and chocolate ganache. And I'll have a little fun with that. Like the pinks and greens will really go and affect them there. I'm going to make it probably like a mint glass and some like a rhubarb jam and stuff. So be a little bit more of the color on that plate as well. So
was it an unusual thing to do, you know, making it match or to reflect the title of the album?
Not really. I love those kind of challenges and really trying to I think it makes you, it forces you to be more creative than like maybe you would normally be. That's why I love like something like this and like dinner and movie. Like it makes me like really stretch what I the way I think of things and makes me kind of go outside my boundaries while still doing things that I like to do.
That was Chef Andrew Whitmoyer of Thunderbird. For more information on the next Avant Brunch featuring Chef Neil Brown, go to imamuseum.org. Another favorite Eat Drink Indiana radio segment from 2015 involved cooking, or rather baking, as I tried to conquer souffles. I tend to get on a kick when I come up with something. Last winter, it was macaroni and cheese. I made probably half a dozen different versions, most billed as the ultimate or the best ever. I eventually found a version I liked best, but by then I was on to another obsession. Well, lately I've been thinking about classical dishes, the old school French dishes that are in Mastering the Art of French Cooking by Julia Child. And specifically, I was thinking about soufflés. Now, honestly, I had never made a souffle, and I don't even recall ever eating one in a restaurant. But I decided last weekend that I was going to make a souffle. If you follow me on Facebook, you might have seen my posts about Souffle Sunday. Well, last Sunday night, I did try making a souffle, and it didn't really come out the way I had envisioned. I wasn't sure if I had overbeaten or underbeaten the egg whites. I just knew I wasn't folding them in correctly, and I knew they were going to deflate, and then I didn't know how full to fill the ramekins, and well, eventually the final product tasted okay, but it certainly wasn't what you would call impressive. So I do what I so often do. I went public and posted on Facebook. I got plenty of comments, questions, and advice, but what I needed was to see someone make a souffle. So pastry chef Cindy Hawkins of Circle City Sweets, who also teaches in the culinary program at Ivy Tech Community College, was nice enough to invite me to stop by the school for a little souffle instruction.
The one we make here in Classical Pastries is a chocolate souffle. It's going to have a little Grand Marnier and some orange juice in it. The other one we're going to do, the French pastry one, is just a plain French souffle, no chocolate. It's just going to be neutral kind of flavor. We're going to make our souffle base first. So we're going to take the orange juice. We're going to heat that up on a saucepan. I'm going to whisk the egg yolks and my first little bit of sugar together. Actually, most of my sugar, not even all my sugar. And then we're going to add the flour and put that back on the saucepan. It's going to get a little bit thick. I'm going to let that get a little bit thick, but I don't want it to boil. I don't want it to reach that boiling point. I just want it thick. Just want it warm. Then we're going to add our chocolate and our Grand Marnier to that. And then basically we're just going to fold our egg whites into that. And we're going to gently bring everything in, put it in our cups, and go.
Okay, so you have heating up the orange juice, right?
Yeah, my orange juice, and in my bowl I've got most of my sugar, the flour, and my egg yolks. So now I'm going to add my warm orange juice to my other ingredients. We're going to just stir that up together, bring it all together, and I'm going to put it back into the saucepan. And then I'm going to cook this till it gets thick. Again, I don't want it to boil. I just want to make it thick. So now I'm putting everything back into the saucepan. Put that back under my heat for just a couple minutes. We're going to keep stirring it the whole time. And again, I don't want it to boil. So when you're doing souffles, you can actually make the base, the first part of it, anything but the egg white the day before. You can have it all ready to go. You know, if you are in a restaurant where you do make these, you could have a bunch of base and keep in the fridge for a day. Then what you do is take that part out and fold in your egg whites, your whipped egg whites, when you're ready to use it. Part of the reason why you don't see souffle in restaurants is a timing situation. It's not a pastry department can't make it. The cooks can't make it. It's you have to really be able to time it just right.
So the customer has to be ready for that souffle when it's ready to go.
Yeah, the customer has to be ready for that souffle when the kitchen's ready to send it out. So there's no sitting around. So you see how thick we got? We've got a nice thick paste. We're going to go ahead and add our chocolate to this, and we're going to just stir it till it all gets melted. I've got just a nice dark chocolate in here, just some Calibo, probably 56 or 64%. We're just going to stir this till it's all melted. As soon as that's melted, I'm going to add my Grand Marnier. We're doing a chocolate orange souffle here.
And it's not taking long to melt.
Right? No. It's pretty warm. Chocolate melts pretty quickly. And then we'll add our Grand Marnier on top of that. And just let this all get incorporated. Then we'll transfer everything back to our bowl and put our saran wrap on top to keep that bacteria and that skin from forming. While that's coming to room temp, we'll go ahead and make our second base with the French Pastry School recipe. And then this will be cool enough. We can do our egg whites. We'll do the egg whites for the second one and then pretty much go in the oven right about the same time.
Now this is from your school.
This is French Pastry School, yep. This is what we had to make as students. This was one of your practical exams during your section. This was for plated desserts class. So this was one of the ones that was on a very strict timeline. So you had an appointed oven time for your souffle. And if you missed your oven time, you were out of luck. You had to wait, and hopefully you could find oven space later. But, you know, I remember as a kid or even watching TV when I was younger, like they would be talking about souffles on a sitcom or something, and it would always be like, don't touch the oven door, it'll collapse, you know. They're fragile. They're not that fragile, you know. I think we get a little crazy sometimes.
So after creating a base for two souffles, one with chocolate and Grand Marnier and one with just vanilla, we started talking about egg whites.
So with your egg whites could always use a little help. Right. Be that a little bit of sugar, be that a little cream of tartar, be that a pinch of salt. They always could use a little bit of something. You can certainly whip egg whites without anything, but this gives a little extra stability. So it'll let it be handled a little bit better. I'm going to turn that one on here. So we've got our first recipe, which was the chocolate. We're going to go ahead and start those egg whites. And these are just egg whites. This recipe just uses just good old egg whites.
I'm always worried that I'm not whipping them enough or I'm whipping them too much.
Well, egg whites are interesting. You know, you can tell by looking at them now, they're nowhere near ready. They're really wet. They're really kind of sloshy. You'll go through a little arc of egg white. There's, you'll get those soft peaks where if you pull your whisk out and you kind of just like pull up a big bunch of your whites, it'll kind of bend just a little bit, kind of hang down. If it hangs pretty low, like the little triangle, little point, soft peaks, not ready. Medium peaks will be a little bit stiffer. Those stiff peaks are usually what we're looking for. If you get them and all of a sudden you're kind of lumpy, there's big pieces of, it doesn't come out really nice and smooth and pretty, you've gone too far.
Okay, now tell me about the ramekins and what you're going to do with those.
Okay, first I want to make sure I have a straight-sided ramekin. Okay. So we've got a couple different ones here. This one, you see it's got that really big lip in it.
Right.
It won't come up as pretty in this one. This one, it's more of, this is a souffle dish. It's kind of more that straight side. I'm going to have some butter that's been melted but re-kind of coagulated a little bit. It's
so you could still spread it.
Yeah, yeah. I want it to be like that soft butter, like kind of butter you could put on toast easily.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and stop these from roasting while we do that, or just I want to keep them moving always. So I'm going to put them on lowest speed.
Right, okay.
So I'm going to take that butter, kind of pasty butter. I'm going to do the sides of my dish. I'm going to just brush up the sides. But I want to make sure I get it off. I've got a little lip. I want to make sure I get that filled in too. Okay? So up and down. Some people say go straight up and down. I honestly don't know if that makes a difference, but it can't hurt, so we'll give it a try. Okay. So I'm going to get all my dishes ready. Then what I want to do is I want to get a little bit of granulated sugar, and I want to sprinkle it. Just like if you were going to coat a pan with flour and you know, butter and flour, same principle. It's going to help it to not stick, but we don't want to put flour on this because why would you want to eat raw flour? Sugar is what we want to go with. So what you always want to do, you want to fold your lighter item into your heavier item. So my souffle base is obviously the heavier of the items, right? It's much thicker, heavier. So I want to take about half or so of maybe a third of this, and we want to just start bringing it in here, okay?
Now, how much do you stir to incorporate? I always
75% of the way.
Okay.
So when about 75% of my egg whites are incorporated, I'm going to grab the next little chunk. What we don't want to do is if you mixed all of it in now, you're going to deflate all your egg whites before you get to the end of it. So I'm going to take the next little bit. The other thing, too, is I watch people fold. This is one of the reasons I like teaching the intro to baking class, because I like them to learn those basic techniques. You watch people fold, they're going, twisting, and, you know, kind of like it looks like they're trying to play golf, like every uncomfortable move. Your right hand, if you're right-handed, your right hand holds your whisk or your spatula. I also fold with a whisk. It also will help to incorporate air if you're afraid of deflating. Your left hand, all it does is spin the bowl. That's all it does. Spins the bowl. With my right hand, I put the spatula in the very center of my product. I lift it, and I set it right back on top. It might not feel like you're accomplishing anything, but I promise you are, and you're not deflating all your egg whites. So then what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this and portion it into my souffle cups. I want it to go over the top. I want it to go too big.
So how much do you fill up?
I want to be able to scrape it off with an offset spatula and cover rim to rim the entire thing, okay? So I'm going to put some in here. I guess I could have grabbed a spoon or something.
So you're really filling it right up to the top.
To the very top. I'm going to actually overfill it a little bit, and then we'll wipe the edges off again. Now, that trick with the thumbnail...
Right, so you're going to run your thumb around the edge.
I'm
going
to take my thumb, and I basically want to separate that top edge. I want to get it away from the lip of the glass, of the souffle dish. So I just kind of, just a little bit of a rim there.
And they don't bake very long, right?
They don't, about 15, 20 minutes. Again, sometimes it can be hard for people to decide when they're done. They're going to have a little bit, almost like a little bit of a wet look on the outside edge. That's okay. You know, it's a moist product, but they're going to still be, they'll be a little bit firm to the touch, but again, you want to be super, super careful with them. They're not the kind of thing that you want to keep opening the oven door. Do you think they're done? Do you think they're done? Because eventually they're going to fall and you're going to be sad. Sad things happen. The key would be make sure you have a nice flat sheet tray. That top one of mine's not terribly straight. Nice flat sheet tray. And just a nice, quiet kitchen, you know, just a nice, nice space where you don't have, you know, people running around and checking things. But again, in no time at all, all of a sudden you'll look and you're like, oh my gosh, they're an inch taller now. So, but it's a lot of fun.
Well, it really was fun making souffles with pastry chef Cindy Hawkins of Circle City Suites. But another fun segment of 2015 involved Indiana's classic sandwich and one of my personal favorites, the breaded pork tenderloin. Last summer, I got the chance to have lunch and talk tenderloins with local musician Rick Garrett, who reviews tenderloins at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. I am a fan of the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich. It's one of my favorites, and honestly, if it's done right, I think it's a terrific sandwich. Flavorful meat, crisp breading, some personality with the whole bigger-than-the-bun thing, and it has a true Indiana heritage. You can clearly see its German roots as a distant cousin to schnitzel. And I've found a kindred spirit in local musician Rick Garrett, who for the past 4 years has written a blog reviewing Indiana's tenderloins, breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. So I was happy to head out this week to a local restaurant to have lunch with Rick and talk tenderloins. So like I was saying, you are the tenderloin connoisseur. So Rick, tell me how you got started talking tenderloins.
Well, I've always loved tenderloins, and my wife and I were at a little pub in Indianapolis, 106 in College, called Jimmy B's. We'd never been there before, and I got the tenderloin and tried it. And I remember I bit into it, and I said to my wife, oh, my gosh, this is the best tenderloin I've ever had in my life. It's incredible. And so we talked a little bit, and she said, you should start reviewing these. And I got to thinking, there are a ton of food review sites out there, but few are specialized. I thought, tenderloin's part of our culture.
It absolutely is, and so it really is a part of Indiana, isn't it?
It is. It is. You find some in Iowa and just a little bit, but in Indiana, it is part of our culture.
So when was that? When did you get the idea to do this?
Well, that was about 4 years ago. So I just scribbled some notes while I was sitting there eating that tenderloin, and went to WordPress and formed a blog and posted it. And suddenly I started getting emails.
Oh, I love that.
And a part of it was because it was kind of an unknown place, wasn't a chain restaurant. So I tend to go towards locally owned places. And I like to go to kind of out-of-the-way places where people don't go. Do hit a chain restaurant occasionally. So it just kind of blossomed from there.
Now tell me how many you've done over the past 4 years.
I've done about 150 over the past 4 years.
That's a lot of tenderloins.
I've eaten more than that. Some I haven't reviewed because they are a return visit. Some weren't worth reviewing.
Well, you know, that happens.
It does happen. It does happen. But I always try to give a fair review and kind of had to learn the difference between a tenderloin and a fritter, because when I was growing up, we had pork fritters as a staple of our diet, but there's a big difference between it.
Oh, exactly. So I think people know, like the frozen pork fritter. That's kind of a college staple, if you don't, a kind of inexpensive item. You see them in the freezer sections.
Right. Pete's Pride is the big one that made them up at Muncie when I lived up there.
Exactly.
I refer to those as kind of cardboard with a crust. They'll fill you up, but that's about it.
But unfortunately, sometimes that is what you get when you think you're going to get a tenderloin.
It is. And I've got to the point where I will always ask, do you have a real tenderloin or do you have a fritter? There are a couple of companies now that are doing real tenderloins, but they flash fry them. So a restaurant might order them pre-made, but they're a real tenderloin. And folks have got pretty good about telling me the truth, although I've had a couple try to pass a fritter off as a tenderloin.
So tell me what you look for when you're analyzing a tenderloin, when you see one come out from on a plate. What do you think?
Well, the first thing I look for is it in a puddle of grease, because it's hard to deep fry something without it being greasy. I've been told the secret is to kind of flash fry it, do it very quickly so the grease doesn't soak into the breading. The second thing I look for is it panned out like a hubcap and,
One of the huge ones, bigger than your head kind of thing.
Exactly. Because I found with those, what I like about a tenderloin is that if it's thick enough, you get the distinct texture of the breading and the distinct texture of the meat. For me, a lot of food is about texture. But with those really thinly panned out ones, they all just kind of mush together and you don't get a good flavor. You just get one crunch and a bite.
That's true. I also don't like the really thin, crispy ones that are sort of cracker-like, and that's all you get is the crunch. I agree with you. I like to have the different textures, and I like to be able to see the meat and the breading. Now, talk to me a little bit about the breading, because I'm kind of picky about breading.
I am a little picky about breading, and I've had some that have had some really interesting breadings. I like the pretty traditional cornmeal-type breading. There's a restaurant up in Pendleton, Indiana, called The Old Trail that breads theirs with potato chips, which is pretty good for about the first half of the sandwich, but then it starts getting soggy. I've had a couple of them, and it's hard to hold the crispness for that breading, through the life of a sandwich. I like to talk while I eat, so it takes a while.
I know. So you're looking for a crisp breading, but now tell me if you notice if the breading stays on. That's one of my things.
I do. I like the breading to stay on. It needs to stay on the meat. So that's not. And the other thing I look for is the shape. Because you can just about always tell a pre-made one, a mass-produced one, because they're all uniform in shape. So if it comes out kind of misshapen, that's a huge plus in their favor.
Okay, so that's something to look for, is that it's not a standardized shape. All right. Now we have to talk bun, right? Because sometimes you get the tiny little bun, so that the sandwich is so much bigger than that is. Does the bun make any difference to you?
Not a whole lot. I like a traditional hamburger bun or the egg buns. I like those awfully well. I think it's easy. You look at a tenderloin and you think it's just a piece of fried meat, but they actually have a pretty delicate flavor to me. And if you get into fancy things like a pretzel bun or there's another one I can't think of off the top of my head, I think it's easy to overwhelm the flavor of the meat itself. So I look for something that's a compliment but doesn't overwhelm it, just like the breading. A lot of people will put, you know, garlic or, you know,
lots of big seasonings in the bread.
Exactly. So that kind of overwhelms the flavor of the meat.
Now, toppings. What, you have favorites?
Mayonnaise, ketchup, and onion. That's my go-to thing there. I think, again, that complements the sandwich without overwhelming it. One of the things I found in doing this is there's a lot of people that actually prefer the fritter to a tenderloin.
No, really, because you know that's just a deal breaker for me when you get the sad little frozen fritter.
It is up in Muncie. There's a restaurant called Richards. You may remember Richards restaurants from up there. They have both a hand breaded tenderloin and a fritter on their menu.
Okay. And you specify which one?
You do, and they say it's about, and here's the tenderloins.
Oh, thank you. This is great. If you're a Tenderloin fan like me, you can follow along with Rick's Tenderloin Tastings at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio here on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. I hope you have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and thank you so much for tuning in to Eat Drink Indiana Radio. And thanks also to our guests, Chopped host and Carmel's own Ted Allen, Indie Film Fest Executive Director Craig Mintz, Chef Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar, Scott Stulen of the Indianapolis Museum of Art, Chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean, and Chef Andrew Whitmoyer of Thunderbird, Pastry Chef Cindy Hawkins of Ivy Tech and Circle City Suites, and local musician and tenderloin connoisseur Rick Garrett. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.